crowds of white-only faces for fees at a fraction of what white performers could command. The gain in popularity did little to increase the respectability of black music until white artists began imitating it. And then, most of the respectability and fame was given to the white artists. Think of artists like Elvis Presley, who have been canonized in the annals of music history for work that was lifted almost wholesale from the backs of black musicians whose names most Americans will never know. Rap has been long vilified by many in respectable white America. It is the language of thugs and is responsible for numerous societal ills, from black-on-black crime to single parenthood. Rap music is the reason why your teenager is suddenly disrespectful. Rap music is the reason why kids don't go to church anymore. Wife leave you? Pretty sure rap music told her to. Rap is, in reality, a difficult and beautiful art form that requires not only musical and rhyming talent, but a mathematically complex sense of timing. Rap is a very diverse art form that can entertain, inform, enrage, comfort, and inspire. Like many art forms, many people will spend their entire lives working at it and will never be better than mediocre. Some, with rare talent, will rise to the top. Others with rare talent will continue to toil in obscurity. But if you are a white rapper, you can be okay and go multi-platinum. Not only can a halfway decent white rapper sell millions of copies of a halfway decent album, raking in money that most black artists would never dream of, that white rapper is more likely to be accepted as mainstream. That legitimacy bestowed by whiteness actually changes the definition of rap for the American culture. When the most popular rappers in the country are white rappers doing a decent impersonation of black master rappers, what kids see as legitimate rap changes. What they aspire to changes. Whom they give their money to changes. When these same white rappers are given Grammys for their attempts over more talented black rappers, it makes it harder for rap by black artists to be accepted by mainstream culture because it sounds different than what they've come to know as good rap. And in all of this, the music that we see on television and hear on our radio is further divorced from the struggle and triumph that inspired it from Africa, through slavery and through today. The art form that black Americans have relied upon for generations is no longer theirs, while the struggle remains. So does this mean that if you are white, you should never rap? Should that avenue just never be open to you? This is the type of question that fuels the most heated debate around cultural appropriation. First off, let's acknowledge that you can do whatever you want. You can rap, you can belly dance, you can do anything allowed by law. But whether you can or should do something is a different matter. That it may be racially insensitive or harmful is beside the point. You can. If you are reading this book, I'm assuming you are doing so because you don't want to harm or offend people of other races. And there's a good chance that at least part of you is hoping that not harming others will also not cause you to have to give up too much of the social and cultural activities you have long enjoyed. But I'm not here to absolve you or condemn you for your rap aspirations. And even if the question of whether or not you could become the world's greatest white rapper hadn't just been answered, it would be completely beside the point. Continuing to look at rap as an example of cultural appropriation versus cultural appreciation, if you really love rap, you love more than just the beats. You love the artists, the pioneers, the science, the history of it all. You love the meaning and the significance of rap, not only what it has meant to you, but what it has meant to the artists and its fans. If you love rap, you love the strength it has provided black people. If you love rap, you understand that it is an art form that has been lovingly grown and nurtured in a hostile world. You also understand that the pain and adversity that helped shape rap is not something you've had to face. When you look at the history of rap, the heritage of rap, the struggle of rap, the triumph of rap, it may inspire you to want to rap yourself. But when all you can take is the art, and you can take the enjoyment and the profit and the recognition, and you can't take any of the pain or the history or the struggle, can you do so and honestly call it rap if you love it at all? But there's an even bigger point to be recognized in all of this. Cultural appropriation is the product of a society that prefers its culture cloaked in whiteness. Cultural appropriation is the product of a society that only respects culture cloaked in whiteness. Without that, if all culture, even the culture that appropriators claim to love and appreciate, were equally desired and respected, then imitations of other cultures would look like just that, imitations. If all cultures were equally respected, then wearing a feathered headdress to Coachella would just seem like the distasteful decision to get trashed in sacred artifacts. If all cultures were equally respected, then white college kids with dreadlocks would look like middle-class white kids wearing the protest of poor blacks against the suppression, degradation, and oppression of white colonialists as costumes. But we don't live in a society that equally respects all cultures, which is why what would otherwise be seen as offensive and insensitive behavior is instead treated as a birthright of white Americans. And because we do not live in a society that equally respects all cultures, the people of marginalized cultures are still routinely discriminated against for the same cultural practices that white cultures are rewarded for adopting and adapting for the benefit of white people. Until we do live in a society that equally respects all cultures, any attempts of the dominant culture to borrow from marginalized cultures will run the risk of being exploitative and insulting. That doesn't seem fair on the surface, that we'd have to wait for a better world before we can start borrowing and adapting from other cultures with abandon. And it does not seem fair to those who feel that other cultures can take from white culture without the same risk of being labeled appropriative. But what actually is not fair is the expectation that a dominant culture can just take and enjoy and profit from the beauty and art and creation of an oppressed culture without taking on any of the pain and oppression people of that culture had to survive while creating it. But who defines what is sacred to a culture? Who defines what was born of struggle? Who defines what is off limits? This is where things get complicated. What is offensive to one person in a marginalized culture is not offensive to another. Some practices have been shared with white culture so long, and the emotional connection to the founding culture is so far changed, that for most, the question of appropriation is moot. And this is where the anxiety lies. Because when you are trying to not appropriate a culture, but also trying to live in a diverse world, it can be hard to know what is or is not going to offend. And it can also be hard to be a part of the oppressed culture and stand up for your ownership over your cultural art and practices, and know that other people from your culture may disagree with you and give permission for what is sacred to you to be used and changed. However this debate plays out for the individual situations you may find yourself in, know that it cannot end well if it does not start with enough respect for the marginalized culture in question to listen when somebody says, "This hurts me." And if that means that your conscience won't allow you to dress as a geisha for Halloween, know that even then, in the grand scheme of things, you are not the victim. Chapter 11. Why can't I touch your hair? I love my hair. It's fluffy and curly and big. I've spent years nurturing it to glory. So much care and so many products and hours of YouTube tutorials have left me with hair that I love more than I love candy or cheesecake. I love taking selfies of my hair and talking about my hair, and if you ask, I will probably let you touch it because it's very, very soft. But I wasn't prepared to be talking about my hair on the first day of my new job. I had worked my ass off for a promotion. It was a coveted new position with the company I worked for. I'd beaten out hundreds of my coworkers and even a few of the managers for this role, and after weeks of interviews and sleepless nights, I'd accepted the role and was finally meeting my new team. The rest of the team flew in from around the country for our initial training. We met for dinner and drinks that first evening at a local restaurant. In a team of over 20, I was the only black person at the table, but it didn't really bother me. I was used to that working in the tech industry in Seattle. That's the way it was. We talked about our respective hometowns, about our families, about our excitement over our new jobs. I was smiling and laughing with my teammates when the director of our division, my boss's boss, spoke loudly from across the long table.
"Is that your real hair?" he asked.
I heard his voice, but his words didn't really register as I was in the middle of conversation with a coworker about his hometown in the South. But people had stopped talking, and I realized that the director had been talking to me. I turned my head toward him.
"Hmm?"
I asked.
"I said, is that your real hair?" he repeated.
If it was possible for a silent table to get even more silent, that is what happened. Everyone stared at me with curiosity while I tried to figure out the best way to answer this question. I decided to go with simplicity. "Yes, it is," I answered, hoping that would be the end of it.
"I'm glad it's not one of those weaves,"
he continued on, giving approval to my personal beauty choice.
"Those are so expensive and really bad for your hair."
Oh my God, why? Why was this happening to me? What prank television show was I on? I smiled weakly. "Yeah, hair can be a big deal to some people," hoping it would suffice. Then came the question I was dreading.
"Have you seen that Chris Rock movie about hair?"
"No, I haven't seen that Chris Rock movie about hair. I don't need to see a Chris Rock movie about black hair when I have my own head of black hair for reference. But if I had a dollar for every white person who has asked me if I've seen that movie and then proceeded to educate me on the problems with my own damn hair and the black hair industry, I'd have enough money to keep myself in Indian Remy for life." A co-worker joined in. "I saw that movie, too. Those chemicals people put in their hair are very dangerous." She looked at me with both concern and fascination. I just sat there in silence, reminding myself that I needed this damn job, so I needed to just smile at this man and maybe have another drink.
"Spending hundreds of dollars a month on your hair? You got bills to pay. It's ridiculous," he continued, oblivious to my great discomfort.
I couldn't say any more. I felt like if I were to open my mouth, I might wail. So I just pleasantly stared until my next drink arrived, and my director got bored and moved conversation back to the teammate sitting next to him. Every month of my childhood, my mom would slather my hair and scalp with burning chemicals. As the chemical solution worked to break the bonds of the curls in my hair, along with removing the top layers of skin on my scalp, I would try not to cry, "It hurts!" I would complain to my mother, to which my mother would reply, "Do you want it straight or not?" and I did want my hair straight. While my mom preferred my hair in its naturally curly, kinky state, I wanted long, straight hair. I wanted the hair I saw on shampoo commercials, the hair I saw in magazines, the hair that boys would want to run their fingers through. I didn't want my stiff, coarse hair that didn't move in the breeze. I didn't want my hair that kids called nappy and ugly. I wanted to be a beautiful girl, and beautiful girls did not have hair like mine. So every month, I tried to burn the blackness out of my hair, and I would then run a hot comb over it, ignoring the stench of burning protein while trying to avoid further injury to my bleeding and scabbed scalp. And still my hair didn't sway in the breeze, and it never grew below my shoulders without breaking off in burned clumps. But I didn't have money for the best solution, the solution of just covering up my hair that refused to be beautiful with long flowing hair of unknown origin. So I had to settle for stiff hair, burned, sprayed, and pinned into poor replicas of the styles I saw in magazines. By the time I reached the age of 30, I had no memory of what my natural hair looked like. All I knew was the disappointment I felt when I looked in the mirror. When natural hair started to become popular again, I took a leap and cut my chemically processed hair off. I was not comfortable with very short hair and spent that entire year feeling self-conscious. But I love a project, and I made loving my hair a personal goal. I set to it and succeeded. And as my hair grew out into fluffy coils, I was finally proud of what I saw when I looked in the mirror. My hair still wasn't what I saw in commercials or in magazines, but it was mine, no longer dictated by the preferences of white America. And it was beautiful. And after decades of pain associated with my hair, after decades of self-consciously patting it down after it became too poofy in the rain, after decades of damage and manipulation, after finally breaking free from the expectations, after resisting the pressure to conform, my hair was still a source of shame. Here was my director, singling me out, in front of my coworkers, not to shame me, but to shame other black women for making different choices than I was now making. To shame other black women for spending a lot of money, to not have to have the embarrassing and demeaning conversation I was now being forced to have. He wanted me to know that he approved of my hair, hair that finally was existing outside of his beauty norms. But still, he thought that my hair growing on my head from my body was within his jurisdiction. Still, my hair would be a tool of oppression. Even if it was to belittle other black women, my hair still existed for his use. Even then, even in a state as removed from whiteness as it could be, my hair was not my own. If you are white, there's a good chance that I know almost as much about your hair as you do. I know how to wash and condition it. I know all the different styles you can use. I know about mousse and hairspray and fishtail braids and that sea salt spray you can use to create that tousled look. I know about all the brushes and combs and the teasing and blowouts because your hair is everywhere. In every movie and television show, there are detailed how-tos in every fashion magazine. The hair of a famous white woman can become a style sensation. I remember the Rachel. Because your hair is good hair. Your hair is the hair represented in the hair care aisles at stores. Your hair is the shining example of health in the shampoo commercials. But it is very likely, if you are not black, that you know very little about my hair. You do not know about my pomades and co-wash, my Denmans and hot combs, my Bantu knots and braid outs. You don't know why I need so many bobby pins, why I put oil over my hair, why wash day is indeed an entire day. Because my hair is not the stuff of commercials or of fashion fantasy. My hair is a mystery on my head, just beyond your reach. I catch people staring longingly at my curls, wanting desperately to make that reach. If I know and like the person, and if I'm in a good mood, and my style can withstand it, I'll sometimes offer up a feel to a curious friend. It's okay. You can touch it, I say, quickly adding, but don't get any ideas. But often, I don't let people touch my hair. Those who do without asking will receive a range of responses, depending on how safe I feel to speak out. But you will never, ever get a smile from me for it. I've had clerks touch my hair at stores, servers touch my hair at restaurants, bosses touch my hair at company parties, and it is never okay, because they never got permission. I'm not the only black person who has a special dislike for uninvited hair touching. When I asked my friends of color what some of their least favorite microaggressions were, hair touching came up time and time again with my black friends. We do not like it, and it's happening far too often. Hair is biologically dead the moment it begins to grow out of your head. It has no feelings, no sentience. To cut off our hair would not cause us any physical pain. So why is hair touching such a big deal? Here are some reasons. Touching anybody anywhere without their permission or a damn good reason is just not okay. We teach our kids about personal space for a reason. If you wouldn't walk up and touch a random person on the back, why would you touch their hair? Don't touch people who do not want to be touched. It's weird. Hair is growing out of somebody's body, coated in different beauty products and a fair amount of sweat and oil. Touching someone else's hair is weird and gross. Everybody seems to get that when someone else's hair is found anywhere, on a seat, on a hotel pillow, in your food, anywhere except on the head of a black person. Hands are dirty. You didn't wash them. Get them and all their germs away from the hair that is literally inches from my face. Curls are precious. That hairstyle that you are trying to send your hands into took more time than your life is worth. Okay, not really, but try me and see. Stranger hands bring frizz and destroy curl patterns, and I will not have it. It is a continuation of the lack of respect for the basic humanity and bodily autonomy of black Americans that is endemic throughout white supremacy. Allow me to elaborate. Since the first black Americans were brought over as slaves, our bodies have not been our own. We were objects, property. Our bodies were curiosities and tools to be inspected and exploited. Our bodies were sources of judgment and shame. But they were never beautiful, and they were never our own. Whatever respect we could get in white America came from how closely we could get our bodies to resemble those of white people. If our mothers were raped by white men and we were born with lighter skin, we could almost be seen as attractive. If our hair was pressed stiff and straight with burning irons or irreparably broken with toxic chemicals, we might be seen as a credit to our race. We were, after all, trying to be less black. And we tried to express ourselves within these rules, tried to enjoy our bodies and our hair within these rules. But mostly we have just wanted to go about our day without the reminder that our bodies and our hair are found brutish and ugly, or fascinating and exotic. We still live in a country where our hair is seen as wild, as unattractive, as unprofessional, as ghetto. We still live in a country where our hair can cost us jobs, even our place in the military. We still live in a country where our hair determines how professional we seem, how respectable we seem, even how intelligent we seem. Our hair is used to help determine our place in a white supremacist society. If you are not black, and you are tired of hair like mine being a mystery to you, there are a lot of ways to get to know more about our hair. You could ask why more black people with black hair aren't in more television shows and movies. You could ask why there are no how-tos for our hair in your magazines. You could ask why our hair products have to take up one tiny section of a completely different aisle in the store. You could ask why our hair isn't called beautiful. Why our hairstyles aren't the ones you are coveting. But instead, you assume you could just touch it. Because it is not about equality or even understanding. It's about reaffirming that nothing and nobody is beyond your grasp. Or maybe it's not that serious. Maybe you just want to know if my hair is as soft and fluffy as you imagined it to be. Trust me, it's even softer. But you still don't get to touch it, not without my permission. Because we still live in a world where little respect and autonomy is granted to black people, where we are constantly reminded of how little control over our lives we have. So maybe for now you set your curiosity aside and allow someone the space to determine who does or does not touch their hair, without labeling them rude, sensitive, or divisive. If you have a loving, trusting relationship with a black person and you are sure they won't mind if you asked to touch their hair, you can consider it. But really, consider what you are asking. Even though it is just hair, dead piles of keratin, as long as our hair and our bodies are judged and controlled and violated by white supremacy, it will always be so much more. Chapter 12. What are microaggressions? Well, you shouldn't wear red lipstick anyway. On your lips, you'd look like a clown. Jennifer said this to me at the end of the lunch period in our middle school. She was leaning against the wall like a cool girl from television. Jennifer had a horizontally striped shirt that was all the rage in the early 90s and slightly slouchy jeans that would only in later years be called mom jeans, but at the time were very in. She had skin that I'd seen in romantic novels referred to as peaches and cream. Her auburn hair was in a stylish bob, and on her lips was a beautiful shade of red lipstick. My mom had just allowed me to begin wearing lipstick the beginning of that seventh grade year. But with all of my mom's lectures on the importance of natural-looking makeup, I knew without asking that I would not be able to leave my house with a bright red shade on my lips. In all honesty, I'd never really thought about wearing red lipstick before, but seeing my too-cool classmate donning the shade informed me that I had been missing out on all that makeup had to offer. I had walked over to Jennifer, pulled by her beauty. I tugged my yellow jacket that I used to hide my belly a little tighter over my body. My too tight jeans made zipping noises and my chubby thighs rubbed together. I patted down the top of my relaxed hair with an inch of puffy roots. Jennifer was everything I was not, but I loved her lipstick, so we finally had something in common. "I really like that lipstick," I said, trying to sound like I wasn't nervous, like Jennifer and I talked every day. "I wish my mom would let me wear a color like that." Jennifer looked at me, smiled briefly, and then said, "Well, you shouldn't wear red lipstick anyway. On your lips, you'd look like a clown." I broke into a cold sweat immediately. "Oh, yeah," I tried to laugh. "I guess you're right, my big lips." I pinched my lips together, trying to draw them into my mouth. "Okay. See ya," I said, with faked nonchalance, and turned and walked away, patting my hair and tightening my jacket once again. I didn't wear red lipstick until after I graduated high school. And not because of my mom. I patted my hair all of the time because of all of the times my hair had been referred to as poofy. Nothing bad was meant by it. Nobody was trying to hurt. It was just an acknowledgement that in a time where people were literally coating their strands in silicone, my hair's volume was a noticeable and unpleasant contrast. My hair and my lips were not the only part of me that was too much. I had taken on quite a babyish voice a few years earlier, after all of the jokes about how my loudness was so typical for a black girl. I didn't know what that meant, because I was the only black girl at my school, but I knew it wasn't good. My butt was also too big. That was made very clear with references to hip-hop songs glorifying large butts that were often recited to me by smiling classmates. I would be having a good day, lost in my imagination, and bam, I'd be hit with a comment that would remind me that I was not allowed to get comfortable. I couldn't walk comfortably, I couldn't talk comfortably, I couldn't sit without patting my hair. I couldn't smile without worrying about how large my lips looked. In spite of all of this, I did really love school. I was a bright kid who enjoyed learning. I was in the advanced program in middle school and finished the last 2 years of high school at the local community college to get a head start on college credit. I had been obsessed with getting into a good college. By ninth grade, I had an entire row on my bookshelf dedicated to college brochures. I wasn't the only one. Other kids in the advanced classes were just as obsessed with college as I was. At first, my eyes would light up when kids would start talking about college. Finally, something we all had in common. After hanging around the periphery of such talk for a few weeks, I finally decided to join in. I began rattling off the colleges that I had hoped to go to when a student cut me off and said, "I mean, you don't have to try that hard anyway, do you? You're black. You don't even have to do well in school to get into college. You don't even have to be in this class." He looked at me matter-of-factly when he said this, no malice in his eyes. The other kids in the group just sort of nodded to themselves as if this kid had said something as plainly true as the earth is round. And although it hadn't been explicitly said, the message was clear. You don't belong here. Even in this group of nerds, this group of people who loved the same boring books and random facts and all raced to be the first to answer the same questions in school as me, I didn't belong. Because I was black. I would like to say that this is when I stopped caring what other people think, that this is when I stopped trying to fit in. But I was a 15-year-old girl, and I was so lonely. So I kept trying. I kept trying to make friends and build community, and every time I thought I'd made progress, someone would deflate all of the air out of my dream. But as painful as it was, I didn't know that it was wrong. I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to be treated this way. I was pretty sure that I was the problem, because nobody came to my defense. Hell, nobody batted an eye when these things were said to me. They weren't a big deal. Just small comments, little jokes. I shouldn't be so sensitive. It was all in my head. If I just found a way to have less things wrong with me, these bothersome comments would stop. So I smiled less, ate less, laughed less, and spoke in a whisper. My senior year, I had been invited to a scholarship conference at a local university for promising students of color. I was very nervous. By then, almost all group social interaction sent me into a spiral of anxiety and depression, and I didn't know any of these kids at the conference. What if I fit in even less than I did at school? I almost didn't go, but the lure of a possible scholarship helped strengthen my resolve. I arrived at the hotel conference room. Inside, there were hundreds of black and brown students. More kids of color than I'd ever previously seen combined. I was immediately overwhelmed by the noise. Kids were laughing in loud, open-mouthed guffaws. Everybody was using their outdoor voice. People were slapping each other on the arm as they talked. Everybody looked like old friends. I looked at the long tables that students were seated at, like a school cafeteria. My stomach clenched. I hated school cafeterias. Nothing lets you know that you are going to die alone, like when you try to find a seat in a school cafeteria and everyone avoids eye contact like you are walking flatulence. I edged closer to the tables and scanned the room, trying to look for open seats without making eye contact so that nobody would have the chance to reject me by looking away. After a few moments, I heard a voice next to me, but it didn't really register. Then I heard it again. "Hey, come on. Are you going to sit or what?" She was talking to me. I sat down gratefully next to her. She introduced herself and asked my name. "Ijoma," I answered quietly.
"What?"
she yelled over the din of the room. I was going to have to use my real voice in here.
"Ijoma,"
I answered again, loudly. One of the college program administrators began his welcoming speech. After a few minutes of rules and expectations, along with a congratulation for our current and future academic success, the administrator finally said the words that 300 black and brown kids had been waiting for him to say.
"We have pizza for everyone."
There was an immediate dash to the table piled high with pizza boxes behind the administrators. Kids advanced upon that pizza like there was a winning lottery ticket at the bottom of every slice. But I didn't, because I was a fat kid. I wasn't just a fat kid, I was a fat black kid, and I knew that rushing to eat the pizza that I so desperately wanted would confirm what was insinuated the many times I'd heard people say, "Well, at least you're black. They think fat women are attractive." What hadn't been said but had been meant was, "It's not okay to be fat, but it's the most we can expect from a black girl." I was so hungry. I hadn't eaten all day. I was just as hungry as every other kid cramming entire slices of pepperoni pizza into their mouths. The pizza smelled so good. I looked at all my options and worked out a plan. Vegetarian pizza. I would grab a single slice of vegetarian pizza. Then, even though I'd still be a fat black girl with pizza, I'd look like I was at least trying not to be. I walked over to the vegetarian pizza. There was no rush to these boxes. I opened a box and looked for a reasonable slice. One big enough so that I wouldn't pass out from low blood sugar within the hour, and one small enough to let people know that I already understood I wasn't supposed to be enjoying it. As I reached for a piece, the girl who had invited me to sit next to her reached for a slice next to it. Then she drew her hand back as if it had bit her.
"Salad pizza?"
She looked up at a nearby friend and shouted,
"Girl, look! They got salad pizza over here! Ha! I'm not eating salad pizza!"
She walked off toward the pepperoni. Another kid shook his head and chuckled, "Salad pizza," to himself. I closed the lid on the box, walked over to the pepperoni pizza and grabbed two giant slices, and I ate, in public, without fear, for the first time in years. Not once in the 2 days I was at the conference did anybody make fun of my name. Not once in the 2-day conference did anybody even glance at my hair. Not once in the 2-day conference was I aware of the loudness of my voice or the size of my ass. Not once in the 2-day conference did anybody question the academic achievements that had brought me there. We were all there because we were smart kids who had worked very hard. For 2 days, I got to feel like the majority of my classmates had felt almost every day, like a complete human being. I don't know how to describe what those 2 days were like for me, except to say that I hadn't known before then that there was so much air to breathe. You know the hypercritical parent in the movies? The mom or dad who finds a way to cut you to the quick right when you are feeling happy or proud or comfortable? Nice to see you're finally trying, or that's a lovely dress. I can't even see how much weight you gained. The remark that seems harmless on the surface, the small sting that comes out of nowhere and is repeated over and over for your entire life, that is what racial microaggressions are like. Except instead of a passive-aggressive parent, it's the entire world, in all aspects of your life, and very rarely is it said with any misguided love. Microaggressions are small daily insults and indignities perpetrated against marginalized or oppressed people because of their affiliation with that marginalized or oppressed group. And here we are going to talk about racial microaggressions, insults and indignities perpetrated against people of color. But microaggressions are more than just annoyances. The cumulative effect of these constant reminders that you are less than does real psychological damage. Regular exposure to microaggressions causes a person of color to feel isolated and invalidated. The inability to predict where and when a microaggression may occur leads to hypervigilance, which can then lead to anxiety disorders and depression. Studies have shown that people subjected to higher levels of microaggressions are more likely to exhibit the mental and physical symptoms of depression. As harmful as microaggressions can be, they are very hard to address in real life. Why? Because they are very hard to see. Microaggressions are small, hence the micro, and can be easily explained away. It is very easy to dismiss a small offense as a misunderstanding or simple mistake. Microaggressions are cumulative. On their own, each microaggression doesn't seem like a big deal. But just like one random bee sting might not be a big deal, a few random bee stings every day of your life will have a definite impact on the quality of your life and your overall relationship with bees. Microaggressions are perpetrated by many different people because each microaggression is just one sting perpetrated by a different person. It is hard to address with each individual person without, one, becoming very exhausted and, two, being written off as hypersensitive. Many people do not consciously know that they are perpetrating a microaggression against someone. Much of our oppressive actions are done in complete ignorance of their effect, or subconsciously, where we aren't fully aware of why we are acting aggressively towards someone. This is often the case with microaggressions. Rarely does somebody perpetrating one say to themselves, "I'm going to find a small way to hurt this person." Having established that microaggressions are hard to see, let's take a look at some of the ways in which they can show up in everyday conversations for people of color. Are you the first person in your family to graduate from college? Are you an affirmative action hire? Wow, you speak English really well. You aren't like other black people. I thought Asian people eat a lot of rice. Why do black people give their kids such funny names? That's so ghetto. Is that your real hair? Can I touch it? You listen to opera? I thought you were black. Wow, you are so articulate. Your name is too difficult for me. Do you have a nickname? Where are you from? No, I mean, where are your parents from? I mean, where is your name from? Is the baby daddy in the picture? You have really big eyes for an Asian person. Why are you complaining? I thought Chinese people loved homework. Welcome to America. Do your kids all have the same dad? You don't sound black. Are you the maid? Excuse me, this is the first class area. Is this a green card marriage? You're so exotic. You have such a chip on your shoulder.
Are you the nanny?
That fiery Latin blood. Did you grow up in a teepee?
Are you visiting this neighborhood?
Your accent is adorable.
Microaggressions aren't always delivered in words. It's the woman who grabs her purse as you walk by. The store clerk following you around to see if you need help. The person speaking loudly and slowly to you because you probably don't understand English. The person locking their car doors as you walk past their vehicle. The high-end sales clerks who assume that you didn't come to shop. The fellow customers who assume you are an employee. The people who decide to take the next elevator instead. The professor who asks to check your sources, and only your sources, just to be sure. The kids whose parents say that they can't come play with your kid. The not-so-random security checks at airports. The crowded bus where nobody will sit next to you. The cab that won't stop for you. For non-whites, racial microaggressions find a way into every part of every day. Microaggressions are constant reminders that you don't belong, that you are less than, that you are not worthy of the same respect that white people are afforded. They keep you off balance, keep you distracted, and keep you defensive. They keep you from enjoying an outing on the town or a day at the office. Microaggressions are a serious problem beyond the emotional and physical effects they have on the person they are perpetrated against. They have much broader social implications. They normalize racism. They make racist assumptions a part of everyday life. The assumption that a black father isn't in the picture reinforces an image of irresponsible black men that keeps them from being hired for jobs. The assumption that a Latinx woman doesn't speak good English keeps her from a promotion. The assumption that a child of color's parents wouldn't have a college degree encourages guidance counselors to set lower goals for that child. The assumption that black people are angry prevents black people from being taken seriously when airing legitimate grievances. These microaggressions help hold the system of white supremacy together, because if we didn't have all these little ways to separate and dehumanize people, we'd empathize with them more fully, and then we'd have to really care about the system that is crushing them. When somebody has perpetrated a microaggression against you, it can be hard to address. There is no guaranteed method for success that will make somebody realize what they are doing and stop. But here are a few strategies that work at least part of the time. State what actually happened. Some things just need to be called what they are, and microaggressions are definitely among those things. You just assumed that I don't speak English. Say it directly. What is happening to you is real, and you have every right to name it. Ask some uncomfortable questions. Because a lot of microaggressions are perpetrated with subconscious motivation, questioning the action can force someone to really examine their motives. Two of my favorites are, "Why did you say that?" and "I don't get it. Please clarify." Ask some more uncomfortable questions. If the person you are talking to becomes flustered or insists they mean nothing by it, ask, "Is this something you would have said to a white person?" Or, "How exactly was I supposed to take what you just said?" Reinforce that good intentions are not the point. You may not have meant to offend me, but you did. And this happens to people of color all the time. If you do not mean to offend, you will stop doing this. Remember, you are not crazy, and you have every right to bring this up. "I can see this is making you uncomfortable, but this is a real problem that needs to be addressed." If you witness racial microaggressions against someone else, you should strongly consider speaking out as well, especially if you are a white person. The strategies above will also work when confronting microaggressions against other people, with a few minor tweaks to ensure that you aren't making this about, well, you. Also, please take the lead of the person of color who is being directly harmed by the microaggression. If it seems like they do not want the issue addressed, do not decide to come to their rescue anyway. People of color have very good reasons for why they choose to speak out and why they choose not to, and you don't want to remove that agency from them. It is also important to make sure that when confronting microaggressions against others, you are not doing so in a way that will place the person of color you are defending at greater risk or will increase the burden on them. Don't make enemies for them. Help when you are reasonably confident that you can do some good. And if that person of color is already speaking out and looks like they could use some support, offer it. It's a horrible feeling to speak out against microaggressions in a room full of white people and be met with nothing but hostility or silence. As a person of color, you don't have to call out every microaggression against you, but you have the right to call out each and every one that you choose to. Do not let people convince you that you are being oversensitive, that you are being disruptive or divisive. What is harmful and divisive are these acts of aggression against people of color that are allowed to happen constantly without consequence. What is harmful and divisive is the expectation that people of color would just accept abuse. While sometimes these conversations about microaggressions can be very healthy and lead to a pleasant resolution, where a well-meaning person genuinely listens and acknowledges the pain they've caused, often the person you are talking with will refuse to see what you are saying and will become defensive. And that's okay. Even that is progress. Because these harmful actions should not be comfortable. And if you get called out enough times, you'll stop, if only to be able to go about your day without argument. And eventually, for many people, it does sink in. Maybe not the first time or the fifth time, but eventually. It is not your job as a person of color to educate people on their racist actions. Please remember that. But it is always your right to stand up for yourself when you choose to. If you have been called out for a racist microaggression and you want to understand and you do not want to hurt people of color, here are some tips. Pause. It is very easy to be overwhelmed with emotions when you are called out. Before you respond at all, pause and catch your breath and remember that your goal is to understand and to have a better relationship with the person you are talking to. Ask yourself, do I really know why I said/did that? Think for a moment. Why did you choose to make that comment? Why did you clutch at your purse? If you can't think of a good reason, this is a good sign that you should examine this more in yourself. Ask yourself, would I have said this to somebody of my race? Is it something I say to people of my race? If it's a comment that is specific to that race, say, assuming that a Chinese American doesn't like American food, ask yourself if you think of and voice similar stereotypes in your everyday interactions with other white people. When a white person orders Chinese, do you say, "But I thought you only ate hot dogs?" Ask yourself if you were feeling threatened or uncomfortable in the situation, and then ask yourself why. Often, microaggressions are a defense mechanism when people are feeling racial tension. You're hanging out with your buddies, and then a black friend comes and joins a previously all-white table. That discomfort might cause you to act inappropriately, acknowledging that the mood has been changed because someone different, who doesn't quite belong, has joined. But instead of investigating your own biases and prejudice that make you uncomfortable,
You take it out on the person who joined by making the difference their problem with a racially insensitive joke or reference. Sometimes you feel challenged by a person of color, and your defense is to knock them down a peg or two. And you do that by referencing their race in a negative or isolating manner. You don't know that's why when you do it, but if you look back at your emotions and see that feeling of threat, you will see that you made a choice to respond in a racially oppressive way, and you need to examine why. Don't force people to acknowledge your good intentions. What matters is that somebody was hurt. That should be the primary focus. The fact that you hurt someone doesn't mean that you are a horrible person, but the fact that you meant well doesn't absolve you of guilt. Do not make this about your ego. If you truly meant well, then you will continue to mean well and make understanding what just happened your priority. Remember, it's not just this one incident. This incident is the continuation of a long history of microaggressions for people of color. Racial trauma is cumulative, and you cannot expect a person of color to react to each situation the way that you would having encountered it for the first time. It may not seem fair that you would take some of the blame for what has happened in the past, but what is truly unfair is the fact that people of color have to endure this every day. The privilege you enjoy in not having to constantly suffer these indignities requires that you at least take responsibility for how your actions may be adding to them and the pain that causes. Research further on your own time. Take whatever knowledge the person confronting you is willing to give gratefully, but do not then demand that they give you a free 101 session on microaggressions. Trust me, whatever it is you've done, it's been done before, and a quick Google search will help you understand further. Apologize. You've done something that hurt another human being. Even if you don't fully understand why or how, you should apologize. It is the decent thing to do when you respect people. You don't have to totally get it to know that you don't want to continue doing something that hurts people. Talking about microaggressions is hard. It's hard for the person constantly having to bring up the abuses against them, and it's hard for the person constantly feeling